All right, we're on the phone now with Franz Witte of Mount Pleasant, who worked for WTMA back in the 1940s. Franz, when exactly did you work for WTMA?
Well, I came to work in the summer, in June, actually, of 1940. College was out, and so I went and auditioned for a part-time summer job. Bill Workman was the manager at that time. He was a former sports reporter for the newspapers, and he had been given the job of manager. So he hired me for the 6 weeks, and before it was over, he offered me a permanent job at $15 a week. And I was interested in getting married, so I accepted the job. And I worked for them until October of 1948.
All right, that was shortly after WTMA came on the air in the summer of 1940. That I don't think the station had been on the air but just about a year or so.
Yeah, the station was originally owned by the Atlantic Coast Broadcasting Company, and the Post and Courier bought them out. I don't know how long they had owned it when I went to work for them. But anyhow, they were the owners. The Post and Courier Company were the owners when I went to work for them. And they hired me as a part-time announcer and also gave me 13 accounts to write copy for. So they broke me in pretty good. Before the 6 weeks was out, they offered me this permanent job for $15 a week, and I was interested in getting married sometime thereafter, so I accepted the job and quit college.
All right, where was WTMA at the time?
WTMA, the studios were located up in Wagner Terrace, up around 14th Street, I believe. This was out in a very marshy area. There was a saltwater creek that ran from the Ashley River underneath this building that we were in. And on real high tide, sometimes you had a difficulty getting into the building without getting wet. But it was a wonderful location for recreation purposes. Some of the boys brought a BB gun out there, and occasionally you'd see a marsh hen running around. They'd try to shoot him, and then they'd put out crab lines and catch crabs, and then we got a few dozen of those. We'd have a crab crank. I'd do that usually when the network programs were on the air. They didn't have any announcer duties except on the breaks every 30 minutes. Back in those days, NBC had two networks. They had what they called the Red Network and the Blue Network. Blue Network eventually became ABC, but we had them both at that time.
All right, how much of WTMA's programming during the time you were there came from the network, and how much of it was generated locally? Do you remember?
It was a fight to get network programs because they didn't consider the Charleston to be in the top 100 markets, so it was mostly local during the daytime. We'd pick up a few afternoon shows. Every once in a while, we'd pick up, say, Gary Moore, who had a comedy show back in those days, and things like that. And occasionally, we'd get some soap operas, you know, like Guiding Light and all that kind of business. But basically, we had to do most of the program during the daytime. Then at nighttime, prime time, then we went on a pretty much full-time on NBC.
What are some of the programs you remember, the local shows that aired on WTMA during the 40s?
Shortly after I went to work there, you know, World War II came up. And so we did a lot of things for the war effort. I wrote a lot of war bond sales-type programs. Then we used to interview after the war got going and they started bringing back the wounded from Europe. We'd go out to the port of embarkation and interview the returning military people. I interviewed one fellow who had been a tail gun on a B-17. When he was at approximately 25,000 feet, the tail got shot off, and he revolved in that tail, spun down to the earth and survived. It was a rather amazing thing. Then we had a Bourbon show with Ralph Edwards, who was at a comic show and a game show on NBC. He came down to Charleston. I built all the sets that he used in the show to raise war bonds. We did a lot of things like that. After the war, the manager of the station was Mr. Robert Bradham. He'd been formerly the sales manager for the Post and Courier advertising department. He took Workman's place. Workman was a Citadel graduate and in the military reserve. And so when the war started to come, he went. He left. And Bradham took over from that point. And Bradham was a very creative sort of fellow. He was really the father of the Azalea Festival. And when that came along, well, of course, he pulled me off the job at the radio station. I spent most of my time building sets that we used in the beauty pageants and stuff like that. I'd had some experience in little theater. I'd been in about 44 plays about that time. Also built a lot of sets. And that was one of the things that we did back then. And then after the war, we built this model home over in Windermere, South Windermere, which was a relative and new subdivision. And I had to create a show to go with it. It was called Linda and Don, a young couple who were just building their first house. And then, of course, we had a mother-in-law out of the picture for some comedy. Basically, basically, that was what I was doing. When I had been there about less than 2 years, they made me program director, and then they put me in sales also. I was in sales. I'd sell the show and then put it on the air. I had a man on a street show, for example, on the corner of Hazel and King Street, or shop down there. That was the type of thing that I was involved in. Just before I left, I became promotion manager.
Which one of your jobs did you like the best?
It was all very interesting. I really liked the on-the-air work more than anything else. Because, I'd been in all these little theater productions of the Dock Street Theater and Footlight Players, and I had several leads. And so that appealed to me, the creative part of it. It was all a lot of fun. But during the war years, when I was program, I was 4F. They wouldn't take me into the Army. We had some right tough times there, because trying to staff the station with announcers. We had all kind of rejects you wouldn't believe. I mean, they had nice voices and so forth, and they had nice resumes, but when you got to know them, they were all a bunch of screwballs, and you could not depend on them very much. So frequently, my work week would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 or more hours.
What kind of news department did you guys have at the time? How did you all gather the news?
When we first got there, the main news we had this AP teletype. We didn't have any particular newsman, but whoever was on duty would go and strip the machine. We usually had 5-minute newscasts, didn't have any real long newscasts. And later, Mr. Bradham hired a fellow, George Griswold, an older fellow who could read pretty well, and made him the news editor for the station. He, of course, used that, and I don't think he really did a whole lot of creative writing on his own. After that, then we had a girl reporter. She did that part-time. She was a copywriter most of the time, but she did go out and actually call on a police department, for example, to get news. But the news back there was not very original, not a whole lot of local stuff.
I'm surprised the newspaper didn't help you out since they owned the radio station.
Well, we clipped the newspaper. We picked up the stuff from the paper, but they set it up as a separate operation. They helped us all they could, but, I mean, it was a separate operation. We were on our own, and we did not have any reporters from the newspapers writing for us exclusively. Whoever was reading the news would read the News and Courier first thing in the morning, and he'd pick out some stories, and he'd incorporate that with what he got off the AP wire, and that would be the news for the day.
Did WTMA at that time have shows like where local musicians would come in and play?
We didn't have any local musicians just for the purpose of musical shows, but we had a lot of religious programs on the air. In contrast to the other stations, we never sold religious time. We had a fellow from North Charleston that would come in, and he'd bring a few singers. That would be it. And then one time we had another fellow that came in and brought some banjos and guitars. He was what we would term one of the radical religions. He didn't belong to any particular denomination. He would furnish his own music. Then he quit. Sometime later, I was called a cab for something. This guy was driving a cab. And I said, "What happened to the ministerial business?" He says, "I couldn't make it in that racket." We had one of the well-known Baptist preachers out of North Charleston was on there once a week. We had the Second Presbyterian Church on once a month. I think that was about the limit to the music. It was either all church music.
Now, in the 40s, they didn't have record shows like they later had in the 50s and 60s, did they?
Yeah, they had record shows, but we didn't have the skill that they have now or the number of stuff. We were constrained by budgetary problems. We had a little girl that used to go buy records every once in a while, and if she spent $5 or $10, I mean, that was all she's going to get to spend that month. So we had this big library that was geared up that had multiple records on it. I forget what the name of the service was. And they had all kinds of music, classical, hillbilly, straight guitar music, Mexican music, symphony music, anything you could think of. But you soon ran through that stuff. After you'd been on the air for 6 months or so, I mean, you'd probably just about exhausted it.
So, for instance, there was a hole on Saturday afternoon when there was no network programming. The first type of show that you would go to would be a record show, right?
Yes, that's what we would do. We'd run whenever we didn't have any program, and that's exactly what we would do. We'd run records. We didn't have anybody that was really into the music of the day.
So the term disc jockey had not been coined during the 40s?
Yes, I think the disc jockey word had been coined, but it had not reached the stage that it did later. We didn't have any famous names in Charleston as disc jockey. That would have to come later. In that area, we were all pedestrians.
Now, what was the studio equipment like in the 40s when you were...
It was very primitive. When we moved from the Wagner Terrace site into the Dock Street Theater,
When did that happen?
And that happened, I guess, about 1942 or 3, along about then. We only had really one studio there, and it was hot as death. They had a window air conditioning put in, and back in those days, they were pretty primitive. It was big, but it really didn't do much for the room, and then, of course, when you were on the air, you had to cut it off because it made so much noise. It got pretty uncomfortable.
This was at Wagner Terrace or the Dock Street Theater?
This is the Dock Street Theater. Actually, it was better out there at Wagner Terrace because you could open a window, and there wasn't much noise, and at least it wasn't hot and uncomfortable. Back in those days, the announcers didn't spin the record. They had a control operator, and he handled all of the recordings or played them for you. When you had a script and you announced you were going to play Blue Danube or whatever it was, and then he would play it.
Were all the commercials done live?
90% of them, because the first recorder we got after the World War was a wire recorder, which was developed in Germany. And then a little later, the tape recorders became popular or became better. If you had a commercial that wasn't done live and it was done on what you call wax, it was recorded on a disc just like a phonograph record. And most of that consisted of national advertising. We had a national representative who called on all of the advertising agents, and he was responsible for creating this business. And when he'd sign a contract with them, say for a bread company or whatever, then they'd send us this platter with all the little commercials cut in, and that's how we ran those. Sometimes we'd have live commercials, but most of that was recorded.
WTMA, would you say the station during the 40s was profitable? At that time, I know there was only one other radio station in town, WCSC.
Yeah, WCSC was our competitor. They'd been in business for a long, long time. It was an uphill struggle. I can remember some weeks when the total billings would just be a few hundred dollars. Back in those days, we were selling spots for, say, if you bought three a week, maybe you could buy them for $1.50 a piece per week. The people that bought the most spots were the bear companies. I remember there was one company, Burger Bear, for example. I believe it was Burger. But anyhow, we tried to get this account. We never could get it. And no matter what we did, we stuck by the rate card. We didn't have any cut-rate deals. At least I had none that I knew of. And we never could get this thing, and I couldn't understand it. And so I made friends with this guy, and I was in the German Friendly Society with him. And one time, we all had a few drinks, and I said, I want to ask you something. Tell me, why can't we ever get your business? And he said, it's perfectly simple. He said, I've got a cut rate. I'm way below the rate cards, and I've got a flat $1 spot rate, and they will never raise it. Well, of course, the competition said, well, we don't cut rates, but the hell, they were cutting them left and right. We ran into all kind of deals like that. But anyhow, it was real tough going in the early 40s. If you ever hit above $500 a week, you're doing pretty good for the total sales. That was local sales, and the national sales was something else. But of course, the networks, they'd take you time, but they didn't pay you very much for the time that they were on the air. Things have changed now, so it's a whole different ballgame. But it was not easy. It really wasn't. You had to get out there and pound the pavement, whatnot. Most of the stuff that I sold, I had to produce myself. The guy said, well, I want you to do it. I had W.T. Smith, for example. He was a Buick dealer down on the corner of Church, Cumberland Street. He was just down a block from the Dock Street Theater. And I did all of his stuff for him. But I had to do it on the air. I had to make up a commercial. And then sometimes we'd get into the business where we would record some. We would use sound effects and that sort of thing. But this was at the end of my career, if not in the first.
Tell me about some of the people that you worked with at WTMA. How many people did it really take to put the radio station on?
We didn't have too many when Bill Workman was the manager. We had Douglas Bradham. He was the chief engineer. We had two others. One was Jeb Bailey, and we had another, I can't think of his name, but we had three in the engineering department. They maintained the station, and they also operated the control board. Later, we would have engineers, and then we had several control board operators. These people did nothing but run the records and put you on and off the air and put the recorded messages on and off the air. When I first went there, we had announcers. We had Kenny Dent, Vernon Bouchon, a fellow named Worthy, and then I think Meredith Smith was a female announcer, and myself. Later on, some of these people left, and we expanded that a little bit. And Mr. Bradham hired Alicia Rent, who played in Gone with the Wind. I think that was her only movie role that she played. But anyhow, they had her as a women's feature commentator and whatnot. Then we had Julia Homer Wilson, who was another copywriter. Like Alicia, she was a fine artist, did beautiful work. I guess because it was necessary to have more than one job back in those days because things were kind of tough. Artwork wasn't selling well. In the sales department, we had, when I went there, Walter Spate was the sales manager. Then it was Whitey Calder, salesman, and Tony Young was the salesman. And then they had me pitching in part-time from the word go. So I helped them out, and finally I got into that primarily. I never got out of broadcasting completely. I was still doing some of that, but I got into sales. In the office, when Workman was there, he had a secretary, Tommy Lee. She later married Frank Sottile. Later on, they hired Margaret Moserman Smith as a bookkeeper. She did that. During Mr. Bradham's era in there, he had so many women, they were running all over each other. That was one of the reasons that I decided to terminate my relationship with the station. When I first went in, they said, well, if we make money, you'll make money. Well, I couldn't see how the hell we could make any money when we had all these people sitting around doing nothing. Or at least I thought they would do nothing. Before I left, they must have had at least 30 employees. We could have run the station just as well with half.